up on the My Ag Life Daily News Report, we're going to talk taxes today. Several farm groups have spoken out against the Biden administration's tax proposals. We'll hear from lawmakers discussing it at a hearing this week, and we also have a look at trade policies. But we start today with a Friday feature. And our featured agriculturalist this week is Mike Moriyama.
My name is Mike Moriyama, and I am originally from this area. I was born in a little town called Delray. Mm-hmm. It's about maybe 6-7 miles away from here. I grew up on my father's family farm. We grew grapes for raisins, of course. We had Muscat grapes. We had Thompson seedless grapes for raisin. And my father also grew strawberries, boysenberries, walnuts, and oranges, all on about 75 acres.
Wow, yeah. That is quite the diversity.
Yes, we actually grew boysenberries too as well. I forgot about that. My dad was really big into berries, apparently.
Uh-huh.
But I had all these nice experiences working in agriculture all those years with my father. He bought the ranch in 55,
mm-hmm.
and so we actually sold it the year I came to Sunbait.
Okay.
I only farmed it with my father for about 4 or 5 years,
uh-huh.
and then I leased it out before we sold the ranch. But my father got a stroke and couldn't help me farm anymore,
mm-hmm.
and I was working full-time at the time. So I decided to, I asked my brother, and he was working in Salinas, and I said, we might as well just sell the ranch at this point. So that was probably the hardest part, because I couldn't really be involved in the ranch anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a lot of good experiences there, and, actually went and attended Fresno State because I was so interested in agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
I attended Fresno State and got my degree in plant science and viticulture. And I worked right out of college working for a fruit packing plant. So I didn't really work in grapes when I first got out of college. I worked there for 5 years in accounts receivable. And then I got a job at the University of California working as a research associate there. So I finally got my dream to work in agriculture and with my degree in research. So I did that for about 11 years prior to coming to Sunbait, and then finished out my career here with a nice coming up 21 years.
Mm-hmm.
Finally decided to retire.
Mm-hmm. So retiring after 21 years, you have seen a lot of changes through the years, I'm sure. Things now are not the same as when you started.
Exactly.
What are some of the biggest changes you've seen?
Really, there hasn't been very much large changes.
Okay.
The only major change is that there's been a lot of acreage lost.
Okay.
When I first started, I mean, there was several acres of raisin grapes in general. The last few years, there's been a lot of pullouts,
mm-hmm.
Mainly due to prices fluctuating. But now the price is finally trying to get back to some type of balance with supply and demand.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really helped us to overcome some of the problems we have with price fluctuations, the roller coaster effect that we see.
Mm-hmm.
But that's probably the biggest change of the acreage loss, price changes. I always look at the raisin price as being kind of interesting because when we used to farm, I think compared to what we get now, prices really haven't changed other than expenses have gone up.
Mm-hmm.
But price for commodities never really followed the price of everything else going up. Labor, cost of material, spray material, everything else has been going up and the prices really haven't followed. And it's kind of hard because everything is based on the market, I understand. But that's probably one of the major changes I've probably seen in this industry is that we're trying to get some kind of supply and demand balance.
Yeah, that is hard. As you mentioned, as you said, labor is going up, cost of inputs is going up, everything's going up, but what growers are being paid is pretty much remaining the same. How do you run a business like that? I mean, we don't really expect other businesses to do that.
Yeah, I know, and it's hard because working in our department in grower services, we have to deal directly with the contact with the growers.
Mm-hmm.
And we hear those stories all the time, is that how can you stay in business when prices don't follow what we're having to pay to bring up to make that commodity for you guys. And it is very difficult, and I know unless you're diversified, you can't really be just a raisin grower.
Mm-hmm.
And we've kind of seen this in years. So a lot of growers have been converting to other crops to become more diversified. a lot of people switching to almonds, blueberries. Some are growers do blueberry, citrus, but they're just trying to do something different to in order to survive.
Right, right. Tell me about your time at SunMaine. Tell me about your position and what you've done.
My time at SunMaine has actually been kind of interesting. I didn't really know what the job was when I first got here. At that time, you know, we were trying to secure product. So we were buying a lot of cash growers. When our new president came along about 3-4 years ago, we stopped that. So now we focus primarily on co-op membership only, and which is made a little easier because we don't have to deal with trying to set an outside price. SunMaine sets our own price for our members, so we didn't have to rely on an outside industry price. But it's been something that I didn't quite understand, but I like the idea of working with the growers. I like talking to growers, and that was probably the most fascinating thing I liked about the job.
Yeah.
Is that even leaving, it's going to be such a hard thing to do because I've made so many good friendships with growers. I mean, it's not like we're that great a friend, but they all want to, hey, let's go have a beer later after you leave, before you leave. I never thought of that. I always just thought of this as being a job, just go out and talk to the growers and then do what you have to do to make them happy. But I like to just work with the growers, just make a little friendship with them, talk about other things, just to kind of, because since it's a grower service position, grower relations position, your job is really just to make sure that the growers are calm and happy.
Yeah.
And so you have to convey that message to them that, oh, everything's fine, which it is, and it could get better. You don't want to give them all the negative, because that's normally the way most growers would be about anything. But you try to show them the positives about the business and positive what could happen, and that, you know, eventually things will turn around and it'll get better.
Yeah.
And it has, especially for our membership.
Yeah. What would you say to the next generation coming in as you're stepping out into a different phase of your life, to those coming into the business? What would you say to them?
I would say, you know, continue to do the same thing. Just be the contact between the grower. The industry is going to be so different from what it was when I was in the business. There's going to be less acreage, less growers to deal with. I don't want to see that most of the growers are more like, they're not corporate growers, but they're larger growers. And we still have a few smaller growers that, you know, it's good to be able to talk to them one-on-one. But there's nothing that I could probably say to them other than just continue to just do your job, be a friend to the grower, be a good bond with SunMaine and the grower, and I think that'll help, you know, do a good relationship with the company and with our membership.
I also talked with Steve Vasquez, technical viticulturist with SunMaine, about Mike and the work he's done. We're talking about Mike today. Tell me a little bit about, when you think about Mike, what are some of the first things that come to mind?
Well, I met Mike years ago. He used to work for University of California, Fort P. Christensen, who was the viticulture specialist at the time. And so he was coordinating a lot of Pete's research. And Pete was known for all his research in raisin production. And at that time, we were transitioning from traditional tray-dried raisins to dried-on-the-vine raisin production. And so all the different components of dried-on-the-vine raisin production were coming together. So we had the right trellis system, we had the right varieties, and we had the machinery to produce dried-on-the-vine raisin production. And so Mike was involved in a fair amount of that research, that initial research, that help growers transition from conventional to dried on the vine raisin production.
What's it like helping growers transition from something like that? I know a lot of farmers, there's a lot of farmers in my family. It's not always easy to get them to do something new. So what was that like?
Well, it's challenging because it's a new system and it involves, some capital to change from one system to another. You're going to have to buy new varieties, so that means eliminating your current vineyard and planting new vines, planting a new trellis system, new irrigation system, so they're going from flood to drip irrigation. And so there's a large cost that comes along with transitioning from conventional to dried on the vine raisin production. And so There's different ways that you can do that, and I think when you're trying to convince growers that there's benefit in that, a lot of them will kind of sit around the outside and just kind of watch the one or two growers that are going to jump in with both feet and really take on a new production system that's going to cost, you know, a fair amount of money, and not really knowing what the end result is going to be, how successful it's going to be.
Well, what are some things that you would say that he brought into the position and that you hope continue on even after he retires?
Well, what Mike brought was, because he worked for Pete, he had a research background. He also worked with a lot of the varieties that these growers were going to transition to, and the trellis systems. And so Mike brought a lot of that knowledge that growers were going to need to be able to transition from that old trellis system and to a new trellis system with stakes and wires and drip irrigation and new varieties. You know, trying to pull all that together in a couple of seasons and be successful, that's a pretty daunting task for a grower. And so the value of SunMade hiring Mike is that he had all that knowledge on those systems and varieties, and he was able to help walk growers through those new systems and help them better understand or better set up their vineyard for success.
All right. Anything else that you want to add?
No, Mike has been, for 21 years, he's been in the raisin industry, and that's just with SunMade. You know, of course, his family grew raisins and he worked at UC. But what's been great is that SunMade has had a trained viticulturist for that long, and someone that, I don't know how he did it, but he flew under the radar. I'm sure he probably got calls from table grape growers or the wine grape industry, but really he's got a real skill set that would have benefited either one of those industries. But he was in the raisin industry for 21 years and helped SunMade transition from the old way to the new way, and he continues to do that now. So losing him to retirement, I mean, we wish him well in retirement, but he's got a lot of knowledge that I'm sure we'll be calling on his knowledge for, you know, the next couple 5 years easily.
These interviews were a video shoot that we did out of the SunMade facility. We'll be posting that online, so keep an eye out for it. Our news brief is coming up next. We'll be right back.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236. Or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you. The My Ag Life Daily News Report is brought to you in part by the California Walnut Board.
Your news brief for today from the California Farm Bureau. For people who operate sod farms, the COVID-19 pandemic and the deepening drought have brought changes in business. The pandemic cut demand from schools and sports stadiums, but brought an uptick in residential business. Drought prompts buyers to seek sod that uses less water, so growers have maintained a trend toward production of water-saving grasses. One grower says the previous drought had a heavy influence on what he markets now. Measuring snow and forecasting how much may be available for future water supply has taken on increasing importance, and the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation will invest $2.5 million in improving its ability to assess the snowpack. One project looks at better ways to measure snow in the San Joaquin River watershed. Other research will employ satellite technology and artificial intelligence. The latest USDA agricultural trade update shows stronger exports and prices than most markets had expected. Gary Crawford has more.
U.S. agricultural product export prospects looked dire, very dire, a year ago, but now...
It's quite a dynamic time.
It's absolutely wild.
Wild. USDA Outlook Chairman Mark Jekanowski, and then you heard USDA economist and trade tracker Dylan Russell. And it's wild, all right. We have the ag export numbers now for the first half of this fiscal year, October through March, and the total export dollar value is...
$92.4 billion. Last year's total at this time was $73.6 billion.
So, Dylan Russell says that's almost 19% higher than the same time frame in 2020. March alone was a big ag export month, over $15 billion worth.
And it's looking like it's on its upward trajectory for next month. It'll be interesting to see what the numbers are.
Meanwhile, though, let's look back at the first 6 months of the year again. How about those corn exports and corn prices?
What can you say? They're amazingly strong.
Corn prices have grabbed a lot of headlines.
As well they should. Corn export demand, a big part of the reason. Outlook Chairman Mark Jekanowski says, as corn traders well know, corn exports were not doing that well during the first half of 2020, but...
They really turned around starting late summer, early fall, and when China entered the market.
And now, for the first 6 months of this trading year, USDA economist Dylan Russell says for corn...
We had $7.6 billion worth of exports, up 127%.
Up from the same time frame a year ago. Meanwhile, of course...
Corn prices are up approximately 142% over the past year.
Russell says it's not just export demand from China and other nations, but also some potential supply concerns developing, including dry weather in Brazil that could reduce that country's corn crop. And Mark Jekanowski, who you remember heads the USDA Supply and Demand Forecasting Unit, the Outlook Board, he told us that this time a year ago...
I don't think many people would have ever predicted that we would be where we are right now.
In fact, even you guys didn't.
In fact, that's right.
That's right, but it's all good there, Mark. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Mexico last week agreed to extend the deadline for U.S. organic exports to be certified to its organic products law. U.S. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack met with his counterpart, and they agreed to extend the compliance deadline to December 31st of this year. Through 2021, USDA-certified organic products may continue to be exported, but on January 1st, 2022, organic products exported from the U.S. to Mexico must be certified to the organic products law standard. Secretary Vilsack this week commented on the deadline extension, saying, "This is another important step for American agriculture and for maintaining positive bilateral relations between the United States and Mexico, one of our most important export markets." Research and development into areas such as big data and artificial intelligence will continue to be necessary to advance climate-smart agriculture forward. Rod Bain reports.
The move towards climate-smart agriculture will involve the developments of and investments in climate-oriented big data and infrastructure research at land-grant universities.
Especially around the climate change, we want to make sure we're filling in knowledge gaps around carbon capture, around modeling, around monitoring and analysis of our carbon markets, and fostering grassroots climate change innovations in farm and forest management. Through our SARE program and our small business innovation program, making sure that we're supporting farmer-initiated and regionally administered innovations in management practices to increase carbon sequestration and improve adaptation to climate change.
That's the director of the National Institute of Food and Agriculture, Carrie Castile, speaking recently at an AgRE virtual panel. She noted what she called high-level priorities regarding the increased reliance on big data and artificial intelligence in the climate smart ag space.
We have some AI centers that we've been able to provide resources to. And then I do want to focus in on a program in which we're going to fund and provide about $500,000 dedicated to developing a public-private cooperative framework based on open data standards.
Also thinking about a cooperative framework or model regarding storage and availability of climate smart big data is Michael Boehm, Vice Chancellor of the University of Nebraska's Institute of Agriculture and Natural Resources.
We're thinking about how can we do a better job, both at the University of Nebraska, but through our partnerships with the Ag Research Service and our partnerships with producer groups, commodity boards, and private industry to pull the data that already is being generated, to pull that together into a bit of a data warehouse, if you will, have it tagged, have it retrievable, maintain the cybersecurity that's part of our life today.
And while Boehm sees a future of producer-led co-ops of big climate data or consortiums of public-private data contributors, questions remain, including,
what are the rules of engagement for accessing that data?
With the result being a complex data system and data sets,
whether it's environmental data about vegetation or drought or field level data about yield, and bring all of that together in a way that adds value to our producers, which then ensures the viability of agriculture production in America, taking care of our resources.
I'm Rod Boehm reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's our news brief for today. Coming up next, we're talking about taxes. We'll be right back.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Agromayor Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agromayor has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Root Pack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agromayor can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Root Pack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today.
Many farmers in California and around the nation are keeping a close eye on President Biden's tax proposals. In a letter to congressional leaders about Biden's tax proposals, more than 40 farm organizations say they're urging congressional leaders to preserve existing rules for capital gains treatment, including the stepped-up basis provided on inherited assets. American Farm Bureau Federation's Pat Wolf told DTN President Biden's plans to raise capital gains and estate taxes would raise taxes on farmers and ranchers, despite the Biden administration's statements that farms and family businesses would be exempt from some of the provisions. And according to AgriPulse, one of President Biden's tax proposals to address economic inequality while raising new revenue for domestic spending priorities would make it harder for farmers to use like-kind exchanges to defer taxes when they sell land to acquire other acreage. AgriPulse also reports that under Biden's proposal, future Section 1031 exchanges could be used to defer taxes on gains of no more than $500,000, a cap that would fall particularly hard on states such as California, where the land value in 2020 was $10,000 an acre, according to USDA. So that means it would only take 50 acres to reach Biden's proposed limit for Section 1031. Tax proposals were a subject of a House Ways and Means Subcommittee hearing this week. Ranking Member Congressman Adrian Smith of Nebraska talked about the concerns from the ag industry during his comments at the hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. to our witnesses for being here today. Mr. Chairman, I rhetorically ask what the primary purpose of our tax code should be. Is it to create equal outcomes across the economy, or is it to subsidize behaviors where we see a public good or punish those where we don't? Every member on this dais has certainly has probably introduced a bill or amendment at some point to accomplish at least one of those two things. However, that is not really what our tax code exists for. Our tax code exists primarily to collect sufficient revenue to fund government in a way which is fair to taxpayers and which is constructive for our economy. And I have some great news that may be startling to many of you. Our federal tax code does a good job of meeting those goals under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. Let's take a look at the primary goal piece by piece and see how we are doing. Are we bringing in the money we need to operate the federal government? In 2019, the last full normal year before the pandemic, federal revenue was $3.46 trillion. That was the most money the Treasury ever took in for a single year, and the revenues of 2020 and 2021 are projected to be even higher. Changes to our tax code made by the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act are not the reason we are running persistent deficits. Question two, is our tax code fair? The Joint Committee on Taxation says that it is. According to a new analysis JCT released yesterday, a taxpayer earning $20,000 to $30,000 per year pays 3.1% of their income in federal taxes. Someone earning between $75,000 and $100,000 pay an average rate of 15.8%, and a taxpayer over $1 million pays 31.5% on average. That is the definition of progressive. And I would like to ask unanimous consent to include that JCT report in the hearing record.
Without objection.
Under the TCJA, thanks to the doubled standard deduction and our expansion of the child tax credit, a single mom with two kids doesn't owe a dime of federal income tax until her income exceeds $50,000 per year. If we want a tax code where the burden of taxation is largely paid by upper percentile workers, we have it. Finally, is our current tax code incentivizing constructive economic activity? Yes, it is. Growth was near 3%. Wage growth was strong, particularly for low and middle income workers. And businesses were investing in workers and creating new jobs prior to the pandemic. This strength continues in states like Nebraska, my state, where our governor carefully balanced COVID precaution with needs like economic opportunity and education. Moreover, TCJA was groundbreaking in requiring businesses to bring back profits from abroad and pay tax on them. TCJA reforms put an end to the exodus of U.S. companies overseas and also created anti-abuse rules to prevent zero tax income in tax havens. TCJA also positioned American companies and workers to compete and win in the global economy. There have been zero corporate inversions since we enacted TCJA. Zero. So why are we here? It seems that the tax proposals in front of us have two goals. One is to raise taxes to partially offset the cost of the president's so-called infrastructure package. I will leave the question of new spending proposals and whether to offset them to the committees and subcommittees of jurisdiction. The other apparent reason for this hearing is the majority's belief certain individuals and businesses aren't paying their so-called fair share. Their answer to this seems to be tax policies that reward their chosen few while targeting other Americans for tax increases, regardless of their impact on job creation, our economy, or local farmers, ranchers, and small businesses. The president's capital gains tax proposals and the various changes associated with it, like the repeal of stepped-up basis, exemplify just how broken these proposals are. On its own, the president's proposal to double the capital gains tax is a substantial net revenue loser, actually. Why? Because economists tell us there is a revenue maximizing capital gains rate, and if you exceed that rate, people won't sell assets and the government collects zero revenue. This lock-in doesn't benefit government, and it's even worse for our economy. The president's answer to this, rather than reconsidering a confiscatory rate, is to force people to pay capital gains taxes at times that are also counterproductive to our economy. Hard to imagine. For example, a recent EY study found that repealing stepped-up basis and taxing capital gains at death would destroy 800,000 jobs over the next decade and 100,000 jobs per year after that. I would like to ask unanimous consent to include that study, as well as a letter from numerous ag groups and a letter from the National Association of Manufacturers opposing that proposal in the record.
Without objection, such will be the order.
Other tax increases in the president's proposal, like repealing Section 1031 like-kind exchanges for real estate, will also cause economic harm for the sole purpose of papering over the president's capital gains rate blunder. My concern in opposing these proposals isn't the wealthiest Americans. They're fine. They've got armies of advisors helping them to navigate a complicated high-tax environment. My concern is the family-operated small businesses, farms, ranches, even middle-class families whose businesses and homes have seen strong appreciation over a generation, who don't have access to those mechanisms and could be very well or could be hurt substantially by these proposals. We have families like this in our districts, like the rancher in Nebraska, the family vintner in California, the single mom on Long Island who scraped together a payment for a house and wants to pass something on to her kids, the small parts fabricator in Kansas. Our friends on the other side will say they want to offer some type of exemption to family businesses. I don't trust that exemptions will actually help folks, because at the end of the day, either the exemptions won't work or the capital gains tax increase won't raise any revenue. American families shouldn't be at the mercy of the academics who are trying to thread that needle right now. We should empower American families and businesses to succeed on their own and not force them to rely on Washington. Mr. Chairman, we have a tax plan that is a proven record of equitably collecting record revenue in a progressive tax system, stopping inversions and driving record job growth and economic growth. It's called the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. Thank you for calling for this hearing today. It's a great opportunity to highlight how out of touch the president's proposals are with the economic realities in our districts, and to highlight how they would be just as damaging to our economy as programs like the most recent UI extension and the so-called American Rescue Plan already are. Thank you. I yield back.
Coming up next, trade policies and how they'll affect ag. We'll be right back.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
My Ag Life, calendar of events. Here's Taylor Chalstrom with what's happening around the state.
On May 18th, we have cover cropping in perennials in the San Joaquin Valley, water dynamics and grower perspectives. And on May 20th, from the Sonoma County Department of Agriculture, we have a webinar for mitigating impacts of plant parasitic nematodes in vineyards. Check out those events and more at myaglife.com. And don't forget that registration is now open for the 2021 Almond Day, hosted by West Coast Nut on June 15th, 2021. It's going to be a virtual event with CEU credits offered.
Get more details at myaglife.com.
The U.S. Senate Finance Committee discussed the president's 2021 trade policy agenda. Ranking Member Senator Mike Crapo, a Republican from Idaho, gave the following opening remarks.
Senator Wyden and I are in strong agreement about how critical it is for us to step up our game in trade, particularly in terms of dealing with China. And I appreciate the opportunity for us to visit with you about that here today, Ambassador. The president's 2021 trade policy agenda opens with two objectives. One, ending the COVID-19 pandemic, and two, strengthening the economy. Significant progress is being made on the first, with record vaccine development thanks to the Operation Warp Speed and continued efforts by the Biden administration to get shots in the arms. Unfortunately, with regard to the second objective, progress is disappointing. Last month, the United States added only 266,000 jobs, far less than the 1 million jobs that economists predicted. President Biden's response is that we have a long way to go. Yes, we do. In fact, more Americans are out of work at the moment than during the worst point in the Great Recession. Of course, Americans have crossed unimaginable distances before, and they will do so again. But why counsel Americans to be patient? It's not in their nature. What we need to do right now is to speed up the journey for everyone by fully reopening our economy and executing an ambitious and sound trade policy. According to President Biden's trade agenda, exports facilitate greater productivity and wages. In fact, President Obama's White House determined that every $1 billion in increased annual exports supports between 5,300 and 7,300 jobs. If the Biden administration wants a worker-centered trade policy, then the logical and only sensible course is to adopt a trade policy that creates as many high-paying jobs as possible. That kind of successful trade policy requires at least three components. First, enforcement must be a priority. The trade agenda notes there will be comprehensive enforcement of the labor and environmental obligations in our free trade agreements. I support that because America's business, workers, and farmers need to compete on a level playing field. We can do that and also stand up for them by challenging other market access barriers at the same time. Enforcement in these areas is complementary, not exclusive. Make no mistake, there is a great deal to enforce. For example, the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, the USMCA, contains groundbreaking market access commitments. These commitments are particularly important to our farmers who have faced a decline in the demand from restaurants, school systems, and hotel customers. We must make sure American farmers get the access to our trading partners to which they are entitled. But the story on enforcement must become better. An important U.S. tariff rate quotas case against Canada remains stalled in the USMCA process. It is time to see progress on it, or the United States must proceed with a dispute settlement panel so that American farmers, ranchers, and businesses can enjoy the benefits they bargained for under the agreement. Mexico is adopting a host of measures that undermine our agricultural rights, including restrictions on biotech crops, glyphosate, and unreasonable food packaging labels. Ambassador Tai, I encourage you to press for action on these barriers at the meeting of the USMCA Free Trade Commission later this month. If our partners should refuse, you must use the enforcement tools at your disposal. The second component of an effective trade policy is negotiating new rules and market access opportunities. To that end, I support the Biden administration's call to work with allies. Yet the president's trade agenda is silent on whether we will continue to negotiate with the United Kingdom and Kenya. I encourage you to work with the United Kingdom, one of the United States' oldest allies, and with Kenya, which can serve as a replicable model for future trade deals in a country where China has failed to get an FTA. And that will also establish our commitment over China's to the people of Africa. Furthermore, we must deepen our engagement in the Asia Pacific or risk losing U.S. allies there to China's predations. While I understand you believe the Trans-Pacific Partnership is dated, I see value in an agreement with new disciplines, including on digital trade. However, that means we must start thinking about how to modernize the TPP or what other structures we can use for U.S. engagement in the Asia Pacific. We cannot simply take a time out from the region. Last month, Japan ratified the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, which is China's model for what trading relationships in the region should look like. In the absence of U.S. leadership in the region, our allies will have to look elsewhere. If the United States is to pursue a worker-centered trade policy, we need to be mindful that American workers lose when China writes the rules. The final but most important component of a successful trade policy is consultation. The Supreme Court noted 60 years ago that the president is strongest when he acts pursuant to an authorization from Congress and is potentially powerless when he acts in defiance. The administration must be strong when it comes to trade policy, and that requires a close partnership between Congress and the U.S. Trade Representative. We recently had a test of that partnership, the administration's decision to support a waiver to the intellectual property protections in the WTO TRIPS agreement. The WTO TRIPS agreement was approved by Congress. The law says Congress's approval can only be withdrawn, quote, if and only if, end quote, Congress enacts a joint resolution to that effect. Last summer, during the height of the pandemic, both houses of Congress declined to act on such a resolution. Yet without any consultation with this committee, you announced via tweet that the administration unilaterally supports waiving the patent obligations of the TRIPS agreement. Chancellor Merkel of Germany asserts the problem with vaccine distribution is not patents, but manufacturing capacity and production standards. Albert Bourla, the CEO of Pfizer, said the decision will categorically create more problems for vaccine distribution. He added that it will disincentivize anyone else in the future from taking a big risk, like Pfizer did, laying the groundwork for classic moral hazard. Iconic American innovators like Bill Gates have also said the decision will not advance vaccine distribution. In short, these observers assert a TRIPS waiver will undermine the very objective on which I said the administration showed some progress, ending the pandemic. Conversely, Vladimir Putin, in fact, supports this decision to pursue a waiver. Neither did it surprise me that a bureau chief for one of China's propaganda outlets replied to your tweet by asserting that global pressure works. You may, of course, have your own good reasons, but to date, you have not offered an adequate explanation. You will need to hear more on this subject from me and my colleagues. Ambassador Tai, I know that you like the expression that USTR can walk, chew gum, and play chess at the same time. And what we need is a USTR that can enforce, negotiate, and consult at the same time. The American people and members of Congress, including myself, are counting on you to prove that is the case.
We have a link to the full hearing in today's show notes. If you know of someone we should feature, or if you have an interesting story to tell yourself, send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson from the JCS Marketing Team. Thanks for listening.